Hello, and thank you for listening to this recording of Business Forward's webinar on the newly released GDP estimates. In this recording, we are joined by Peter Borish, the Chief Investment Strategist and Portfolio Manager of Quad Capital Management Advisors. The first part of the presentation has a visual element. If you would like to view the charts, please visit bit.ly/Q1 2018 GDP slides. That's all one word, all lowercase, bit.ly/Q1 2018 GDP slides. The first voice you will hear is Jim Doyle. If you would like to join us live for future calls, please go to our website, businessfwd.org, and sign up.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining today's webinar. I'm Jim Doyle with Business Forward, and I'll be moderating our conversation today. Currently, all lines are in listen-only mode. We're pleased to welcome Peter Borish, Chief Investment Strategist and Portfolio Manager at Quad Capital Management Advisors, LLC. Before joining Quad Capital, Peter was a founding partner and director of research at Tudor Investment Corporation. He served on the board of the board advised the Institute of Financial Markets, the Futures Industry Association, and the Chicago Board of Trade. As a philanthropist and entrepreneur, Peter's been active in education reform. He was a founding member of the board of directors of the Robin Hood Foundation in New York, and also a co-founder of Math for America. Peter's here to discuss the Q1 deal GDP estimates that were released by the Commerce Department this morning, and he'll also talk about the Employment Cost Index results released by the Labor Department today. Each quarter, we try to cover a different viewpoint on the economy. Our call last quarter focused on tax policy, for example. In this call, Peter will be focusing a lot more about the markets and how they're reacting. This will be an interactive briefing, so after the presentation, we'll have time for questions. For those of you who are new to our programming, Business Forward organizes local roundtables, Washington fly-ins, conference calls, webinars, and media trainings for more than 100,000 business leaders across the U.S. At these briefings, entrepreneurs, investors, small business owners, and executives get the chance to brief policymakers on issues affecting their businesses and how Washington can work with business to accelerate our economy. To date, more than 600 mayors, governors, members of Congress, and senior administration officials have participated, and this is all thanks to the support of more than 60 of America's largest and most respected companies. Before we get started, I'd like to cover a couple of housekeeping items. First, if you don't have the presentation in front of you, you can find it on the email confirmation you received for this call. There's a link that says Open Visual Interface. Just click on that. Or you can go to businessfwd.org and look for the post with the link there. As I mentioned, there'll be time for questions and comments. You can participate in one of two ways. You can press 1 at any time to be entered into the queue to ask your question live. Or you can email it to info@businessfwd.org, and I'll read it aloud. Again, you can press 1 to be entered into the queue to ask your question live, or just email it to us at info@businessfwd.org. If you're emailing it to us, please include your name, business, and your town. And if you ask it live, we'd also appreciate that information, too. Finally, this call is on the record, and there may be reporters present. With that, let's get started. Peter, I'm just going to quickly run through the numbers on the Commerce Department issued at just a very high level, and then we can dig in after we just run through the numbers. Lexi, if you start on slide 2, economic growth. The economy grew at 2.3% in the first quarter of 2018. That's down last quarter's growth of 3%. Most people project the annual growth will be about 2.7% for the year. You go to the next slide. Consumer spending. Consumer spending rose by 1.1%. This is a big drop from 4.0% in Q4. Some of the comments this morning have focused on the fact that cars sales and other durables dropped in part because of the storm. But there's also a little bit of concern that perhaps the tax cut isn't having the impact that people thought it would. Next slide is business investment, which grew by 6.1%, down from 6.8%. Again, there's some of the commentary focuses on the fact that companies may have accelerated their spending in Q4 last quarter in anticipation of the tax cuts this year. But 6.1% growth in the first quarter for business investment. Next slide. Housing activity was flat at 0.0%. Most of the commentary we've seen so far focuses on the impact of rate hikes and the reduction in the mortgage interest deduction. Peter, I'll have a lot to say on that. Then next slide, exports. Exports increased 4.8%, down from the growth of 7.1% in Q4 2017. And then finally, inflation. General inflation rose 2.5%. Core inflation increased at 2.7, I believe. And then finally, the employment cost index, we saw an increase of 0.8% for the first quarter. So, Peter, those are the numbers. How are the markets reacting?
Well, the markets, first of all, thank you, everybody, for having me. I always like to do a full disclosure that as a chief strategist, I'm far better at explaining yesterday than I am going forward. So accept that with the caveat as we discuss these numbers and really what's going on, which is quite interesting. The markets, of course, had a tremendously strong open on the NASDAQ with Amazon's earnings. And they've been pulling back since then. I look at the entire notion of what's going on in the yield curve. I look at sort of what I call, you know, silver, Dr. Copper, which is off 2.5% today. Silver really looks like it's breaking down. So some of these numbers are confirming, or the markets, I should say, are confirming a little bit of this notion that this economic weakness that we saw in the first quarter, where many people think it tends to be just a seasonal reflection that for a number of reasons, first quarter growth is the weakest of the year, may not be the case because we've had the implementation of the tax, if you want to call it reform or cuts, however you want to define it. But when you look at the numbers, when I look at residential investment being zero, a lot of that I think has to do with the shape of the yield curve and the fact that it has been flattening significantly, both the 2.10s and the 2.30s. And if you're in the housing business and you're borrowing short and lending long on the financing side, that has been squeezing your profit margins. We've seen that in a little bit of weakness, surprisingly so, in the financial stocks. And also, there's been surprisingly slow growth recently in with the survey data and real data coming out of Europe, and everybody had expected Europe to be moving stronger, which is why you've seen the exports decline, where you would have thought that they may, you know, relative to the prior quarter, picked up more because of the weakness in the dollar.
And how does the market's reaction to the numbers this quarter and the numbers themselves impact the Fed's decisions on rates that we're expecting the next remainder of the year?
Well, that's an excellent question. So if you looked at the wording and the prior leadership of the Fed, they always use this notion of data dependent. So they were going to be a little bit slower and sort of reacting to data instead of acting on an anticipation. And this Fed seems to be more interested in acting on anticipation, which I personally think could lead to a policy flaw. So they are on a tightening schedule. They've given no indication that they're going to slow that tightening, even though the numbers themselves across the economy have not been particularly strong. What's been incredible is if you take initial unemployment claims, which came out yesterday, and you're at the lowest level, absolute lowest level since the middle 70s, but when you adjust that for population growth of working age population, those numbers are truly outstanding. And that, combined with the fact that we've had muted wage growth, says that, and again, in our opinion here at Quad and what we're looking at, and then not seeing that in sort of, as I said, in copper and silver, really an underlying demand pickup. And so wage growth isn't growing that rapidly as we saw in the ECI this morning. And as well, inflation expectations haven't really picked up, though crude oil itself is up 40% year on year, even though it's sort of in the middle of its range if you go back the past 10 years. We happen to think it's closer to the upper end of the range, and you've seen that, for example, in the performance of Exxon. So what we try to do, and we're looking at markets and saying that's the ultimate crowdsourcing sense of information relative to the fundamental data that's coming out, and we look at how that reacts. So it's not just the number itself, it's the number relative to the expectations and then the market reaction. And then we kind of look at the epsilon of what the actual number is relative to market expectations. And in this case, the ECI was at really above the upper range of expectations, but still the 10-year bond is, in terms of yields or prices rallying, yields are selling off today. Again, that's a market saying, huh, we just don't see a lot of demand, though with this slower growth, the likelihood of the CBO estimates from just last week of where deficit growth are already looking to be too low. That's a long answer. I apologize.
Well, let's unpack that a bit. Let's first talk about the wages, and then I would love to cover the impact on the debt. So the ECI at 0.8% was higher than expectations, but your take is that it's still modest, and the market's take is it's still modest. How can employment claims be so low and unemployment be so low compared to other times, and yet wages just aren't growing enough?
Well, that is the conundrum for all of us economists, that one would think that if you sort of believe in supply and demand and so unemployment claims are low and unemployment itself is low and there's, you know, you look at the jobs openings, that's high, that you would expect that demand would increase the price of wages, but that is not. So whether that's a function of businesses, and I'm sure people on the line know this a lot better than I do, in terms of productivity or the nature of the jobs that are being created are lower wage service type jobs where there's more substitutional effects and that higher end wages. And in the aggregate, I know in my industry, sort of in the financial services hedge fund industry, the compression of the lower end has sort of come up, but the need to pay significantly higher at the upper end has declined, and that too may have something to do with the aggregate lower wage increases.
And I also moving to the
No, I just do want to add one thing that we look at all the time here, and relevant because of Amazon's earnings came out. Two things that we always track are we've been tracking Visa and MasterCard. I call them the new brokers. So whether you're shopping from your couch or you're going into a store, those are, people are using their cards. They have stayed up. So they haven't shown material weakness. They didn't go down as much as the stock market did when we had that correction. So there shouldn't be any indication that the consumer may be slowing, but there's no real warning signs yet that, you know, we're turning over. We just might continue this chugging along. And if you look at the GDP figures, even back to the beginning of your chart, except for the recession, they've all been in that range. Maybe that's just a sign of a maturing, aging economy.
So with that in mind, let's cover the other point you raised, which is, how this actual growth compares to the growth assumptions that were made as part of the tax reform package. what is the short, how big is the shortfall, and what could that mean for the cost of covering the increase in debt?
Well, I think you have to sort of mark the shortfall by three things. So you have the president's pronouncements of we're going to have, 5% whatever growth. So we can discount that completely, and that didn't go into the projections. You can go into the congressional projections, which may have gotten up to the middle threes in the CBO recently, which is in sort of the lower threes, and now you're looking at the numbers you just said, sort of the mean economist growth is in the upper twos. So that spread will increase both probably government spending on some of the transfer payments and safety cost issues, and it's going to significantly reduce tax revenues. Now, there's a potential offset for some of that, which I find particularly interesting, which is the cycle of tax cutting, particularly at the state and local level, may be ending. I think that that's part of the message that you've seen from the West Virginia, Kentucky, Arizona, I think New Mexico, if that's the fourth state, of teachers, because their real wages have declined dramatically, and I think now they're going to say, wait a second, what about us? We voted, we supported this, lower taxes, but it starts catching up in terms of real wages and services on that level, and that to me is something to think about going forward as far as taxing and spending.
And if we are in a world where we're just going to continue to chug along at this high twos, how do you expect the markets to react? Are we going to, will we see less volatility?
So the really interesting issue is, are we going to chug along, or, as I said just before, is the Fed in the potential position that it is going to make a policy mistake because it's not being so data dependent, and it wants to try to get ahead of its perceived curve of growth and inflation, and it ends up raising rates too rapidly, and somewhere later this year or early next year, we end up having an inverted yield curve. So we could chuck along, but I think the risk is now more tilted toward a policy mistake. So then you ask about volatility. Yeah, because when you have sort of greater potential policy uncertainty, that's going to be reflected in market uncertainty. And we look at volatility not just to the downside but to the upside. If you think of Amazon today with a market cap of $800 million, after its earnings released, and it bought, Whole Foods for $3 billion, and its market cap went up $80 billion today, which is essentially Amazon's market cap. It basically gave birth to a company larger than Starbucks today. I mentioned Starbucks just because their earnings came out. So it's kind of mind-boggling, and is that part of the wage conundrum, because the winners are just winning and they're getting bigger and everybody else is sort of struggling for the leftovers, which again to me is not healthy or sustainable. And we've seen that with the decline in the market cap of Apple because of the fact that, and this is a normal cycle, at some point the marginal innovation in technology says, I can hold off. I don't need that $1,000 iPhone 10, and their shipments have been less than was originally projected.
One aspect of the economy and the markets that we haven't covered is currency. The dollar is strengthened recently. What's your take on what's going on with the dollar, and how's it going to affect the markets and GDP?
So I think there are two aspects to the dollar. One is the fact that we're now a net exporter of of crude. And I think that that's crude prices are a potential wild card, but the fact that crude is denominated in dollars and then people have to then purchase dollars to buy that, and as that holds up. So I'd look for a little higher correlation among the price of crude relative to the dollar price. The other issue, of course, is that it's kind of mind-boggling that our 10-year yields have moved up. You know, they went to 3%, now they're at 2.9, but Germany has not budged. They're still at 60 basis points. Japan is still at 5 or 6 basis points. Italy, Spain, they're all lower. France, they're all 10 years are all lower than ours. So there's that appetite to say, wait a second, I'd rather be there. Again, growth in Europe hasn't matched expectations. The emerging market equity markets, you know, Russia, Turkey, Indonesia, and then going across over to DAX, CAX, have not kept up with us. So the dollar on a, for some technical reasons, as I said, and also on a relative basis, has seemed to have some increase in demand, which the countervailing to that is you wouldn't think if we were having such large deficits and projected deficits that that would be the case. Because our, you know, if you look at where our projected debt to GDP ratio is, if we were a non-U.S., people would be very, very concerned about that. But of course, we have some special things. We issue debt in our own currency, et cetera. And there's the thinking down the road that if it gets to be there, the Fed can always try to monetize that.
So it might be helpful for you just sort of explain, because there are some people on the call who may not have understood the part about the different rates across the different countries. Could you just unpack that a little bit more?
Sure, with pleasure. The on an absolute basis, U.S. domestic interest rates still seem low relative to history, but current rates relative to the rest of the world in the U.S. are high. And that is something that could attract capital to our market, help finance our deficits, and of course then lead to higher demand for the dollar. If I sort of ask a normal person and say, hey, should U.S. 10-year yields be higher in the U.S. or Italy, given everything that's going on in Italy right now with trying to build together a coalition, the uncertainty, the economic weakness, people would be very surprised that our interest rates are far above those countries. And so that's, again, sort of the puzzle that we don't live just in an isolated domestic U.S. economy, that there's leakages abroad and there's this multiple feedback loop, which makes, as I said at the very beginning, forecasting in a macroeconomic sense extraordinarily difficult, because we have, you know, and we haven't even spoke about tariffs, we haven't spoke about, you know, is Korea, you know, one would think that the announcement last night, that would have been met with more optimism in terms of less uncertainty, and that should be bullish. So there's a lot of these different cross currents, but what the market is saying is for some reason they do not think that European growth and interest rates are going to pick up anywhere near the pace of which ours are.
Thanks, Peter. So now we'll open up to questions and comments. If you have a question, just press 1 on your dial pad to speak live, or you can email it to us at info@businessfwd.org. And please remember to introduce yourself with your business and where you're calling from. We've already got a number of emails and a number of them talk about tariffs. The first one here is from Sonia Martinez in San Antonio, Texas. How will tariffs levied on steel and other goods affect manufacturer prices? How will retaliation affect our exports?
Well, that is a unbelievably good question, and now I always have to come up with my full disclosure, which I am a I'm a Democrat that believes in markets, and so I watch the markets closely. When I think that if we had, you know, sort of 50 years of policy of, you know, capital transfer, open borders, free flow of people, ideas, and if we're going to reverse that policy and expect to have the same outcome, to me, that's a bit of a mistake. So I always say, right, you buy the rumor, you sell the facts. So, for example, U.S. Steel topped the day of the announcement of the tariffs and then sold off. Economics indicates that if you are a strong economy like the U.S., in isolation and you have buying power, you would probably benefit from a tariff. But that's only assuming that the other side doesn't retaliate, which I think we've seen both in particularly in China, that's not going to be the case, and also that we continue to have some stronger aggregate demand. We talked about that may be weakening. These tariffs, which are essentially a tax on U.S. customers, means there's substitution effects, and that too is potentially deflationary, and maybe that has something to do with the yield curve, assuming the Fed has the ability to control the shorter end and the market is pricing in the longer end. Remember, 30-year paper is only, you know, 3.15. And when things are here, and I'm always cynical, if you're a little bit concerned, you know, sort of where are we in economic and political paralysis in D.C., would you rather be owning 30-year Apple paper or 30-year U.S. government paper in terms of the likelihood that it's going to be paid back with certainty? And I think that's driving a lot of things. And so the tariffs and the potential retaliation lead to uncertainty. Uncertainty leads to slower decision-making, which then leads to, you've seen, an slower investment and lower GDP growth.
Next question is from Joyce Scott from Houston, Texas. Have our long-term economic metrics remained as the economy shifted? Is our USA economy still as dependent on non-manufacturing sector as it was in the last century?
I think that it should be the other way around. The U.S. economy is far less dependent on the manufacturing sector currently than it was in the last century, primarily because of enhanced productivity and enhanced technology. That goes into the wage growth question, because there's many, many more needs in the service area, particularly as we all age. And in my case, if you have, you know, aging parents and their health care needs and health care workers, those are lower wages, which have been substituted out of higher cost manufacturing jobs. One can also see you sort of match the growth of real wages with the percentage of employment that's part of a union, and that has declined dramatically. So that's lessened the ability of workers to negotiate and get higher wages. I think the one very insightful part of her question, which is implied, is that we tend to think of technology improvements just on the supply side, that we are able to add more supply because of the enhancements of technology. But it also means that we use everything more efficiently. So it means we use less of it on the demand side, and that's why we've had this underlying deflationary pressures in the manufacturing sector, unless we have, so if you look at the supply and demand at any given price, you have, you know, more supply because you're using it more efficiently with technology, you have less demand because you're using it more efficiently with technology. So unless we have a shift in the entire demand curve, which we have yet seen, and that's where these muddling GDP figures say, it's unlikely that we're going to have a significant pickup in inflation.
Our next question is from Earl Speed from Des Moines, Iowa, and it relates to wage growth. ECI growth also includes cost of benefits, which presumably includes healthcare. Is that offsetting wage growth? I guess if the 0.8% increase, how much of that is spending on benefits?
So I'm not in front of my desk, so I have to be honest. I don't have the breakdown of the benefit and wage growth, which is an excellent question. So we've seen that the rate of inflation in healthcare has slowed, which was put from an underlying ECI perspective. But there's so much uncertainty right now in that. If you think about the elimination of the individual mandate and the decision making of do you have insurance, do you not have insurance, I look at, you know, I try to anecdotally look at things in my own life of a 27-year-old daughter that was switching from one job to the other, and she's going to take a couple months off, and she's saying, like, wait a second, COBRA is ridiculously expensive. I'm 27. Should I go without insurance for 2 months? Of course, I'm always there as a potential backdrop, and I look at it as a trade going, that's crazy. As a parent, I might subsidize you. But if you don't have that ability, that in itself is going to be a changing mix of what's happening in the healthcare marketplace going forward. And I just think that it has yet to be sorted out because it's very early on in terms of what that elimination of the mandate means, what it's going to mean for changes in insurance pools. But so far, we've seen lesser growth in the rate of increase in healthcare benefits.
We have a few questions that relate to President Trump and uncertainty. Some of these questions refer to his attacks on specific companies, so Ford Motor Company or Amazon. And then there are also questions related to the risk of the special counsel. How much is this affecting the markets, and are the markets beginning to get used to this? Are they reacting less strongly to the more recent attack than they did initially?
Well, I think you have to start with Amazon, which has been one of his favorite punching bags, and we just saw that it made a all-time high this morning. So markets, you know, work. They're predicated on supply and demand. And, yeah, I guess I would say that it's a little bit like the boy who cried wolf on this issue, except we all know what happened at the end of that story. So that makes me somewhat concerned with regard to the marketplace. But on any individual tweet, I think that, yeah, people are getting used to it because that's how markets work. I'm not saying that that's particularly healthy, nor, again, from my earlier comment, do I think that that's particularly sanguine economic leadership, which leads to further uncertainty. I certainly can't comment on, you know, I have no insight with regard to the special counsel probe or the situation with Michael Cohen. I look at myself as a economic historian, so I look at a few facts. One, the year after major tax legislation, both after Kennedy, Reagan, Bush, and now under President Trump, the markets itself tends to have far more volatility than the preceding years. One of that is if you're uncertain and tax rates are lower, you're more willing to sell, particularly mentally, because you're like, well, I'm not giving as much back. If you look at normal volatility around an individual equity, if you randomly, and we've done this study, sort of chose a price to sell, that could you buy it back at the tax rate, current tax rates, over the course of a year at a lower price from where you sold it, offsetting that tax? And the answer to that is generally yes, because the average volatility of an individual equity, of course, is far larger than the market as a whole. So that leads to some volatility there. You know, being in New York and hearing everybody discuss what's gone on there, I do think the delta of President Trump being at risk in terms of greater distraction has certainly gone up. But if we say, well, this was something in the realm of President Clinton, and if the Democrats win the House in the fall, which is looking increasingly likely, and they move towards impeachment, there's no way that it's going to get through the Senate. And so is that an exercise in futility? So I think the market, you know, always learns from history. So there's more uncertainty, more potential volatility. But unless for some unknown reason information comes out and the president resigns, I think, or, you know, the special counsel finds that he's done something, you know, that merits high crimes and misdemeanors, the notion of impeachment, I don't think people believe is going to happen in the marketplace.
So one last question is from Letitia Harris from New York, New York, and it relates to tariffs and also to reductions in immigration benefiting Canada vis-a-vis the United States. This may not be an area where you can cover answer it quickly, but how much is Canada benefiting from the decisions we're making on immigration and on trade?
Well, if you look at the home prices in Toronto, relative to our home prices, clearly they in Vancouver and elsewhere, they've been far stronger than our domestic prices. You know, every business and everybody on the phone, again, they know this a lot better. They're probably hiring far more people than we are. You're only as good as your human capital. The wider the net of which you can potentially pull out of that human capital, the better off every business is going to be. I do think that there's some other subtleties in that with regard to the immigration and how that affects some local economies with regard to college students, Chinese students coming who pay, you know, full tuition, and now they're choosing to go elsewhere, not just Canada. So these are all interesting things for me as an economist, that prices are made at the margin. So the marginal demand for educational facilities at the higher level in the U.S. has been declining. The marginal case of you know, more sophisticated immigrants working, that also not only affects housing prices, but that also affects the relative competitiveness, which is insightfully mentioned in the question there, vis-a-vis our closest counterpart in terms of culture and language, which is Canada. So I think it's an excellent question, and I do think that it benefits them. And, you know, up until recently, their currency has been stronger and their growth has been a little bit stronger as a reflection of that, particularly when you start going down into, you know, looking at domestic consumption and things like that.
Thank you, Peter. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you all for joining us. Please check your email for a post-event survey where you can let us know what you thought of today's call. We also have the links to the slides still on the website, so if you have any questions on that, please just let us know. And Peter, we really appreciate you making time for us today.
I enjoyed it very much. Thank you, you know, hopefully in a few quarters, what we said today actually is coming to fruition, and we can join on another phone call.
we'll brag about it in 6 months. So thank you, guys. I really appreciate it.
And if not, we'll destroy the podcast.
Have a great day, everyone. Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye.
That'll do it for us here at Business Forward. Thank you for listening, and thanks to Dokashiteru for use of their song, Destination Not Specific, which is used under a Creative Commons license. You can hear more Creative Commons music at dig.ccmixter.org. Would you like to hear the next call live? Go ahead and sign up at businessfwd.org. Thanks so much.